Ow!
Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
Listen to me.
Sound off 126 here on SCScoops.com for Sunday, September 19th, 2010, Night of Champions Sunday. I am the Solemn Monster. I'm going to give some quick predictions on Night of Champions tonight. Talk a little bit of Raw, a little bit of NXT, and the glory that is Michael Cole. And a couple of other things, too. But I've got something I need to get to first. Kind of the top story, if you will, this week. Now, I should say that I actually was planning on covering a different topic here this week. I've gotten emails from people, you know, fairly often, and it seems more so now than ever before, asking, Solemn Monster, what would you do if you were in charge of WWE? What changes would you make if you were in a position of power within World Wrestling Entertainment? So I decided to put together a bit of a WWE business plan per the Solemn Monster. And it doesn't so much deal with creative. It's not a layout of storylines for the next 6 months or anything like that, but it's a business plan. And it's changes and improvements and tweaks and additions and some fresh ideas that I would bring to the table if I were in charge of WWE. If Vince McMahon was suddenly struck by a bus and by chance, in his will, he left the company to me, because you know I'm all about realism around here. So anyway, that was going to be the subject of this week's podcast. I actually have only done one other special edition of the Sound Off dedicated solely to one topic. As one of our listeners so astutely pointed out, it was actually Sound Off 25, where I did an entire podcast of my five feuds, fantasy feuds that I would book if I were in charge. And it's kind of a themed edition of the Sound Off. And that was my plan for this week. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to save that for next week. I'm going to save that for 127. And right now, what I want to talk about is stupidity. Now, everybody in their lifetime, some more often than others, has said something pretty stupid. I mean, I'm guilty of it. You're guilty of it. Let's be honest here. We're all guilty of it. We're all human beings. Nobody's perfect. And it's not so much that there's stupid people out there as much as you have people that say and do some pretty stupid things. So this seemed like the perfect week for me to talk about two individuals who have done or said something recently that is pretty fucking stupid. Let's start with somebody. This is more of the breaking news item here. We'll talk about somebody by the name of Chael Sonnen, who I'm sure some of you at least are aware of. I've talked about him on this podcast before. He is a UFC fighter. And not only is he a UFC fighter, but simultaneously he's also run as a state representative in the U.S. Senate for the state of Oregon. Very intelligent guy. Or so one would think. Now, Chael Sonnen was a virtual nobody in UFC. And slowly but surely, he racked up a couple of pretty impressive victories. He's a very well-spoken, very articulate guy. And he had a fight on the UFC 117 pay-per-view in early August with Anderson Silva, who is a Brazilian mixed martial arts fighter for the UFC. He's been the UFC middleweight champion now for years. He is easily one of, if not the most dominant fighter they have in that company. He's had a string of pretty boring fights, mostly him toying with his opponent, to the point where UFC promoter Dana White said, look, if you pull that shit again, we're going to get rid of you. I don't care how good you are. So that's Anderson Silva in a nutshell right there. So, hence we have this Anderson Silva-Chael Sonnen fight that nobody has high expectations for, because Anderson Silva, who doesn't speak much English, or at least he likes to, you know, lead people to believe that he doesn't. Some people think he speaks perfectly fine English, but you would never know it listening to his interviews. People didn't have very high hopes for this fight. And so hopes were pinned squarely on the shoulders of Chael Sonnen. Chael Sonnen was going to have to do a miracle job of promoting that fight for it to do any sort of business. And in fact, what ended up happening was he did perhaps one of the best jobs of all time that I've ever seen any wrestler or any fighter, any athlete do when it comes to promoting a fight, a match, or an event of some kind. It was the Chael Sonnen show for the weeks leading up to that pay-per-view, which, from what I understand, I don't know if there's an actual solid final buy rate in. The belief was that the pay-per-view probably did around 600,000 pay-per-view buys, which, by UFC standards, is not that great, but it's still a pretty damn good number. And it was probably at least 250,000 buys more than that show had any right to do. And you can clearly give credit to that to Chael Sonnen. He did a phenomenal job. He's also one of these guys that will talk out of his ass. He's a very entertaining guy. Listen to any of his interviews, and it's hard to take anything that he says seriously. I mean, kind of like Hulk Hogan or John Cena, only worse when it comes to these media interviews. You know, he made comments, for example, about Lance Armstrong leading up to the fight. Clearly, he was just trying to get publicity for the fight, saying that Lance Armstrong gave himself cancer, you know, because of all the performance-enhancing drugs that he did. And I think that same day, Chael Sonnen was a guest on Jim Rome's sports TV talk show, and Jim Rome called him out on it and said, "Did you make these comments?" And Chael Sonnen said, "No, I didn't make those comments. In fact, I'm good friends with Lance Armstrong, and I saw him at the training facility earlier today, and he was kind of kidding me around about it and saying, why are you saying all these things about me?" And he said, "No, that didn't sound like me at all. In fact, it sounds like somebody who speaks Spanish. It sounds like a Hispanic man," which, of course, it didn't. Jim Rome went on to play the comments right then and there. It was clearly Chael Sonnen, but he kept going and saying, no, it's not me. So, in any event, the show did really well, and Chael Sonnen did really well. Nobody gave him a prayer against Anderson Silva. And what ended up happening was Chael Sonnen had the fight won. I mean, these guys went at it for 4-plus rounds. It was a knockdown, drag-out affair. If you're a UFC fan, you loved it. If you're only casually or loosely an MMA fan, kind of like myself, even I enjoyed the hell out of that fight when I saw it, you know, after the fact. And Chael Sonnen had the fight won. If the fight had gone another, you know, to the end of the round, or the next round, whatever it was, he would have won on points, and he would have been the new champion. And he would have done what nobody thought he would do, back up all that trash talk. Unfortunately for him, as shitty as Anderson Silva looked in that fight, Chael Sonnen made one very grave mistake, got caught in a choke, and was forced to tap out with literally seconds left in the round. I mean, it was pretty dramatic stuff. So, of course, even though Anderson Silva won and retained his title, the talk shifted to a rematch. We must have a rematch, and that rematch most assuredly will be worth at least 1 million pay-per-view buys. Vince McMahon could only dream of getting that number of pay-per-view buys for a WWE show these days. And Silva suffered, I think, a cracked rib. There was some question when he would be ready. They were looking at February for the potential rematch, and it would have been huge, huge, huge business for UFC. And then the bottom fell out this weekend when SureDog.com, which is one of the more popular fighting websites, reported that Chael Sonnen had failed a drug test that was administered the night of his fight with Anderson Silva, which, mind you, was back on August 8th. So it's been many, many weeks before these results came out here. Now, had he tested positive for what they consider a drug of abuse, like cocaine or heroin or marijuana, that would have come back a long time ago. So this would indicate a performance-enhancing drug failure. We don't know what drug. We don't know anything else, really. Chael Sonnen, I believe, was only first informed of this on Friday and has not yet made any remarks. To say that this is embarrassing for Chael Sonnen, to say that this is embarrassing for UFC and crippling to them in terms of losing one of their biggest potential pay-per-view main events of the next year would be an understatement. But what it also illustrates is how incredibly stupid and short-sighted somebody could be. Explain to me how Chael Sonnen could possibly believe that this would not come out after his fight. I mean, he has continued to talk trash since the fight. It's not as though he's been silent since the beginning of August. He's been crowing about a rematch with Silva, and he has not stopped. And then news of this comes out. Now, I fully expect Chael Sonnen to deny this. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but he'll probably come out and say, it wasn't my blood, it was Hispanic blood. or something like that. Something preposterous. And maybe that's part of his gimmick. Maybe it works. You know, maybe he just continues to talk trash, and eventually, when the fight, or I should say, if the fight ever does happen, it'll still do big business. But, you know, the fact is, if this is true, and it sounds as though it's coming straight from the California State Athletic Commission, so it must be true. We don't know what drug or drugs he failed for, but usually that carries with it an automatic suspension of at least 1 year. So, suffice to say, we're probably not going to be seeing Chael Sonnen fight for quite a while, if ever again, in UFC. Stupid! To say that this may be one of the dumbest, just one of the greatest acts of stupidity I have seen in quite some time. Which leads me to my second example of stupidity. And that is one, Matt Hardy. Matt Hardy. Obviously, many of you are aware of the YouTube videos that have been going up. The various cryptic postings and messages by one Matt Hardy on Twitter, Facebook, and whatever else. It appears at this point that Matt Hardy is trying to get himself fired. I can't be sure of that, but it certainly seems that way to me. Matt Hardy does not strike me as being an unintelligent person. And in fact, I may have even mentioned this last week when I talked about Matt Hardy, but, you know, when Matt was coming up in North Carolina, and of course he grew up, his brother Jeff and all their friends like Shannon Moore and Shane Helms and, you know, Marty Garner and the Omega crew and all those guys, Matt was always cited as the brains of the operation. You know, they ran their own little wrestling promotion, and Matt kind of ran the quote-unquote business end of things. And, you know, Matt's always been a relatively safe and smart performer inside the ring, and knows the value of his brand. In fact, if you look at his Twitter name, it's Matt Hardy Brand. He has created a brand for himself. You know, all the videos, the Hardy Show that he sells on DVD and everything else. He knows what he's doing. And then we hear that on the recent European tour, he was sent home. In fact, there were two separate incidents, in fact, involving Matt Hardy. There were two separate incidents. One that kind of boggles the mind, in which he was supposed to be part of a tag team match and simply left the building and was unavailable for the tag team match. And they had to scramble to come up with a substitute for it. And then on a different night, he was not in a condition to perform backstage, which usually is the indicator of something quite ominous. So anyway, Matt Hardy has not been endearing himself to too many people. And then, of course, we hear about the Soma ban by WWE. Now, it has not been explicitly stated that this is due to an incident involving Matt Hardy, but you can draw your own conclusions from that, and I'm going to talk about Somas in a little bit. So, Matt Hardy continues to post messages online. He continues to post videos of himself online. Now, that first video of him from the hotel room in Europe, where he says, well, you know, all the wrestling websites and the Dirt Sheets and the Torch and all these different sites, they must not know what they're talking about, because they said I was sent home, but my God, I mean, cars are driving down the wrong side of the street. Look at the signs here on the wall in the hotel that I'm in. It's center is spelled C-E-N-T-R-E instead of C-E-N-T-E-R, which must mean I'm not in America. So at this point, I figure, okay, Matt Hardy, it's obvious, is on ecstasy. You know, maybe a little PCP, LSD, throw some coke in there. He's obviously not all there. And in fact, in the video, he did not look very well, which could just be part of the gimmick. You know, let us not forget those old Angelic Diablo videos that he was posting after the whole, you know, Matt Hardy and Edge thing. It was this character that he came up with for himself, which was just fucking stupid. So anyway, the important thing to note here is that at no point in that video did Matt admit that he, in fact, did get sent home, quote-unquote, by WWE. He did not deny the story that he was sent home from the tour. Yes, he was physically not yet home. WWE cannot deliver him to his doorstep in Cameron, North Carolina. So, of course, he denied nothing and basically looked like a fucking idiot. And then, of course, he's posted other videos since then. And the basic gist of these videos here, which I have watched, is I'm going to be just fine. I've got to do what's right for me. Big changes are ahead in my life. And if I'm not being treated well in one place, I may have to go to another place. And then there were a series of tweets that he had answered on Twitter. One person just quite directly asked him, look, you know, I'm going to be going to a TNA live event in Berlin in January, so, you know, what are the chances that you'll be in Berlin then as opposed to in WWE? Or, like, where should I go? Should I go here? Should I go to Berlin? And Matt's response was, I would go with Berlin. Now, this does not mean that he's going to TNA. This is Matt Hardy, you know, just trying to keep his name out there. Maybe it's all part of a gimmick. Maybe it's all one big work. It's not, but you never know. Or maybe Matt thinks he'll go to TNA, and wouldn't it be funny if Matt gets fired from WWE and even TNA won't take him? I mean, I'm sure they will. TNA will take almost anybody. And they have Jeff Hardy under contract and Shannon Moore, who I'm sure are going to be pushing very hard if they're not already for Matt to come in. So I'm almost positive that, you know, when and if Matt leaves WWE, and actually it's a matter of when, not if at this point, he'll probably have to wait out his 90-day clause. But there is no doubt in my mind he will end up in TNA. And look, I hope he has more success in TNA than he has in WWE. WWE could definitely have used him better. I don't blame them for not using Matt Hardy properly right now, because the guy is a fucking train wreck. Do you really think that Matt Hardy is a sound mind and body right now? And I mean sound mind and body, because clearly he's not in the physical shape he was once in. I know that he's had some health issues. He likes to talk about the fact that his intestines exploded. I think he had an appendectomy and had his appendix removed. Lots of bad luck for Matt Hardy. But still, that's no excuse. There have been pictures online of him and his big gut, and he claims he's lost weight. You know, in one of those videos, he claims that he cut red meat out of his diet, and he's already lost 13 pounds or 21 pounds. He's gone from whatever it was, 245 to 224. And it does look like he's lost a little bit of weight. I hope he loses even more. You know, I hope that he gets himself in shape, he clears his head, and everything's cool. Because the way things have been going, you know, it's not just a matter of, oh, Matt's going to get fired. You know, you start to worry a little bit here, like, what if something else happens? You know? There have been wrestlers that have done some pretty fucked up things, and you never would have expected it out of them. I mean, Chris Benoit is probably the best example of that. I'm not saying I expect Matt Hardy to become the next Chris Benoit, but what I'm saying is, Matt Hardy, if, God forbids, he did something to himself, or he went on a murderous rampage backstage at a WWE show, it would not be a situation where I'd go, man, I didn't see that coming. It would have been, why didn't somebody stop him in the first place? Because clearly the guy's not all there. And quite frankly, I'm sick of hearing about Matt Hardy. I'm sick that I'm sitting here on this podcast talking about him. I'm sick when he posts a new video of himself. Like the last one I saw, it looked like he was in Toys R Us, and in fact, apparently he was in his own home. He just buys all of the action figures that have ever been made of him, and he has literally shelves of them in the background. I swear to God, I thought he was in Toys R Us. I mean, when I realized he was actually posting that video from his home, I was just like, wow. This guy obviously has a very high opinion of himself. So, for Matt Hardy's sake, I hope everything he says is true. I hope that he's doing well, and he tells us not to worry about him, and he's going to be A-okay. But Matt Hardy is as good as gone from WWE. It's just a matter of when and not if at this point. And if I'm Vince McMahon, I'd probably keep him around for whatever. I don't know how much time is left in his contract, but just to fuck with him, because he's created so many headaches for the company recently. Just based on whatever shit went down on that tour, it's a black eye for WWE. And again, you have Linda McMahon running for Senate. They're ultra-sensitive to these things. Ultra-sensitive to these things. If I'm Vince McMahon, I'm pissed that I have to waste any of my time worrying about one of my employees like this. But the fact is, if I'm Vince, just out of spite, I'd probably keep Matt under contract for the length of his deal and put him on job patrol, suspend him, send him home, let him sit. That's what I would do. He could certainly let Hardy go and let him go to TNA, and I don't think Vince is concerned about a Hardy Boys reunion at all. You know, when Jeff Hardy went over there, and Jeff Hardy was the most popular wrestler in the world last year, the fact that he went to TNA and it made absolutely no difference to their bottom line is pretty indicative that TNA as a brand is so weak that you could send every top wrestler that there has been in the last 15 years to TNA. Steve Austin could breach his contract with WWE and go to TNA. The Rock could join TNA. Hulk Hogan's back could suddenly recover and he could start wrestling matches again. Matt Hardy could go there. Everybody under the sun could go there, and they still would pop their little 1.2 rating every week. I am convinced of that. Their brand is so badly soiled, they're going to have to change their name, their initials, they're going to have to change management. Everything about that company would have to change for them to have a prayer of competing with WWE. So anyway, the point is WWE is not worried about TNA at all. And they're not worried about Matt Hardy going there. I just think they're trying to figure out what the fuck do we do with this guy. So Matt Hardy, as smart as he may be, is incredibly stupid right now. Because it's past the point. Look, if you wanted to leave, just go to management and say, look, I want to be let go. I want to be let go out of my contract. And they'll either say, okay, or they'll say no. But at least then you'll know where you stand. And maybe he's done that. There's been no indication of that, but perhaps he has done that. But I'm so sick of hearing about Matt Hardy. I am so sick of his videos. I am so sick of his left nostril, of his stringy hair, of his big gut. If I never have to hear about Matt Hardy again, I would be happy. So to Matt Hardy, I say, just shut up. Please, just shut up. Just go away. Can you imagine, just imagine for a second, if Matt Hardy was like you and me. Matt Hardy had a normal 9-to-5 job. He was working in an office. He was wearing a suit and tie with that stringy hair ponytailed back behind his head. And he goes and he sits at a desk all day. I don't even know what he's doing. He's working at a computer. Whatever he's doing, he's cold calling people. He's a telemarketer. Could you just imagine this for a second? If Matt Hardy was upset over something, he felt he didn't get the promotion that he deserved, and so he decided to start posting videos on YouTube and posting messages on a Twitter about the fact that, you know, my bosses are holding me back, and, you know, these executives don't know talent when they see it, and he... Could you just imagine? He would be gone that day. They would send security people to physically remove... They wouldn't even let him remove shit from his desk. They would send security people to grab him by each arm, and they would literally physically throw him out of the building. Onto the street. Actually, that would be quite comical. Trying to envision Matt Hardy in a different series of real-life situations. So, but again, just imagine if anybody did this at their own job. If you had two competing companies and you worked for one of them and you were unhappy about something, you went public, and it's not even like you're going public under some sort of anonymous name. You're going public as yourself, saying, you know what, I don't really like the people I work for, but I would love to work for the other company. Do you know what would happen to you? Not only would you be fired, but you're building up a reputation for yourself as a headache that nobody wants. Because if this is the way you behaved in this company, even though you want to work for me, I don't want to hire you. You're a loose cannon. What's to say you're going to turn around and do the same thing to me? He's not doing himself any favors. Let's put it that way. So anyway, that ends the Matt Hardy talk right now. I'm sure there's going to be more Matt Hardy news, if you know what I mean, in the next couple of weeks. And we'll certainly, I'll certainly talk about that if need be. But let this be the end of Matt Hardy for now. I am done with Matt Hardy. Matt Hardy is behaving stupidly. Everybody can see that. It's a train wreck waiting to happen. Actually, it's a train wreck that is happening. It's a disaster waiting to happen is what it is. And, that pretty much covers the Matt Hardy. So, Matt Hardy and Chael Sonnen, two stupid people who are... Two smart people, I should say, who have done very stupid things. It is a shame. The Chael Sonnen thing just blows my mind. Matt Hardy, I've come to expect it, but just had to lead off the podcast by talking about two very stupid things done by two pretty smart people. And they are prime examples of what not to do. Now, since we can never truly get away from Matt Hardy, and we don't know for sure that this comes as a direct result of anything that he did, but the really big story of this week, a lot bigger than I think people are making it out to be, is the fact that WWE made actually multiple amendments, but one really, really big change to its drug testing policy, or as they call it, the wellness policy. And that, of course, is the banning of the popular muscle relaxer called Soma. Now, Soma has been around in the wrestling business for probably decades. And, I remember when Louis Spicoli died in 1997. I'm pretty sure they found him in a bathroom, possibly by the toilet. I don't remember if Spicoli... Let me see here for a second if Spicoli choked on his own vomit. But I think Somas were involved in his death. I think he was abusing those pills, and he died. And there's probably other wrestlers that have died, too, as a direct result of Soma use. Using Somas in and of themselves won't kill you. It's the abuse. And that goes really for any medication. I remember Nick Dinsmore, who, of course, was the former Eugene in WWE. I believe he was sent home once for an incident at a hotel where he was found passed out. Lance Cade, who unfortunately did die from what we don't know yet. But he had drug issues as well. He died several weeks ago. And when he was fired the first time from WWE, it was a result of what they call a soma coma, as it's known in wrestling circles, where he was on a flight with other wrestlers, and he, I believe, had also passed out as a result, presumably, of overuse of these drugs. And they had to, I think, reroute the flight and land so that he could be taken off. And you could find just numerous examples of this from over the years. A lot of wrestlers use somas. A lot of wrestlers. And when I heard that a large part of the WWE locker room was extremely pissed off this past week with Matt Hardy, I have a feeling I know why that is. And WWE, if you look at the language that they've put into the policy here, which I have up here, I mean, this is the one little snippet that they added. They added a section for muscle relaxers, and it says as follows, quote, "The non-medical use of drugs belonging to this class, including but not limited to Soma," I'll use the, I won't use the medical name for it, it's called Soma, "and Miltown or Meprospan is prohibited. The non-medical use of drugs belonging to this class is prohibited, regardless of whether there is a prescription. The use of muscle relaxers known under the generic name Carisprodol," that, of course, being Soma, "and Meprobamate," which, of course, is Miltown, "will be considered a non-medical use for purposes of this policy and is prohibited." So, that's pretty big news right there. Now, of course, I'm sure people who are on one thing will just shift over to using another thing. But this has been a problem off and on for a long time. A lot of guys obviously are on some sort of muscle relaxer. People have had problems with pain pills. People have died. We've seen how many wrestlers have died. I mean, there's a reason why all these young wrestlers in recent years have died. And it's not because they're all on hardcore street drugs like cocaine. It's because they're either mixing alcohol with drugs, which you can never do, or it's an abuse of prescription pain pills and muscle relaxers. So this is huge, and it's going to have huge repercussions, and it's going to be very interesting to see if any other stories come out of this, or if TNA, quite frankly, who boasts their own drug testing policy, follows WWE's lead. TNA would really be showing a spine and showing that they care if they turned around and said, you know what, we're going to do the same thing. And it's not a matter of them copying WWE. It's because it's the right thing to do, and because TNA's drug testing policy, by and large, by all accounts, is a joke. And that would be a big step towards making it less of a joke. So we'll see what happens. But that was a big story that, again, it doesn't feel as though people really see it for being as big as it is. But it really is a huge, huge story. And it's a big change to the wellness policy. Now, the other thing WWE got hit by this past week, which is potentially a big story, although I'll believe it when I see it. You know, there have been instances, including one fairly recently, where there was a lawsuit brought on WWE by some wrestlers that included Raven, as a matter of fact, disputing the independent contract status of wrestlers, trying to, you know, recognize them as employees, which WWE does not do, and therefore their wrestlers are not afforded the same benefits that, say, an executive working in Titan Tower would be in terms of a 401k and health insurance and things of that nature. So there was an article that ran in the Connecticut Post this past week, and this has become a big campaign issue potentially now for Linda McMahon. So, you know, the article basically says Linda McMahon has been touting her prowess building and running World Wrestling Entertainment, which, let me just interject here for a second. I knew that this would come back to bite her on the ass. You know, for all the talk about how, you know, I see these campaign commercials for her where they say, well, she built a multi-million dollar company and added 500 jobs to the state of Connecticut, and she built WWE. I mean, I've seen articles that reference, that have a picture of Linda, and it's become a situation where it was always Vince McMahon Vince McMahon was always the known figure. It was always about Vince, and now it's Linda McMahon and her husband, which was the funniest. I don't remember where I saw that, but it was a photo in an article, and it just said Linda McMahon and her husband. It didn't even give a name. That's what it's become. So that's fine if you want to run on that, because really Linda doesn't have anything else to run on. You know, she's been an executive within World Wrestling Entertainment for many years, but by no means is Linda the head person, as she would have everybody believe, of WWE. Linda has had very little compared to her husband to do with WWE's ascension to superpower, but she likes to take credit for that. That's fine. But it's a double-edged sword, because when you get pushed on the issue and all the bad stuff starts to come out, you can't turn around and say, well, you know, I didn't have anything to do with that, or, you know, you could talk to WWE, or you can talk to my husband. Well, no, you've taken credit for it already, and so now you've got to answer these questions. So basically, the crux of the article is saying that WWE is the target of a state audit. This is by the state of Connecticut. It's not a lawsuit that's been brought by any one individual or ex-wrestler or anything like that. Basically, they're cracking down. They've been cracking down on companies that misclassify regular employees as independent contractors, usually to avoid paying Social Security and Medicare and taxes and things like that for those people. So basically, the state is looking into WWE to see if, in fact, they have misclassified their wrestlers as independent contractors. Is politics being played here? Is Linda and WWE being wronged? Perhaps, but it's hard for me to have sympathy because I happen to think that the wrestlers should be classified as employees. And if the state of Connecticut finds that to be true, even more than that Soma ban, this is potentially a huge story. But like I said, I mean, we've been teased about this before. It's like when Congress said they were going to crack down on WWE and really look into and investigate the company after the Benoit stuff. And it was all threats. You know, Vince went to Capitol Hill and he testified, as did Dixie Carter. And nothing really ever came from that. And I would guess, my guess, nothing comes from this either. But potentially it's pretty damning for WWE. By the way, quick TNA note here. I've had people email me and email the website asking about Desmond Wolfe, London Brawling, basically the team of Desmond Wolfe and Brutus Magnus in TNA, and what happened to them, and, you know, who failed a drug test or what went down. As best as I can tell from what I understand, Desmond is the issue here. It's not Magnus, it's Desmond. And it's not because he failed a drug test or he misbehaved or, you know, pulled a Matt Hardy or anything like that. There I go with Matt Hardy again. Desmond apparently, I guess he was undergoing some sort of test or physical or whatever, and they discovered some head issues or issues related to head trauma, prior concussions, and he is going to be kept out of action for a little while. Could be as much as 2 or 3 months. So Magnus has not been brought into any of the TNA tapings, even though Desmond is backstage. I think he lives in Florida now, but Magnus still lives in England, and, you know, TNA is always looking to cut costs and avoid certain expenses, and if that team is not going to be in action, they just see no need, I guess, to fly Magnus in, which is a shame, because you can still use Magnus as a singles guy, and I think he's got potential in that company, and you'll see, he's one of those guys when I do my WWE review next week that, you know, if TNA were to die tomorrow, I think Magnus would be a good pickup for WWE, because he has a good look. He's improved in the ring. He's still very young. He's in his early 20s. I think there's a lot of potential there, and it's a shame that in a way, not that Desmond is being punished, but Magnus really is being punished for something that has nothing to do with him. So that seems to be the issue with Desmond. They found some health-related stuff. They got to keep him out of action. And you know, it kind of goes back to when WWE passed on him. You know, Nigel McGuinness was a big star, former Ring of Honor champion. That was his former name, Nigel McGuinness, and I couldn't understand why WWE had not gone after him sooner. When I found out that he was on his way in, he was just going to undergo some physical testing and then, I guess, sign his contract, and WWE found something in the physical that made them pass on him, and that's when TNA scooped him up, of course, because that's what TNA does best. At the time, I thought it was related to his biceps, because anybody that followed Nigel's career in Ring of Honor knew he had issues with his arms. He suffered, I think, a biceps tear on both arms, I believe, and continued to wrestle. He just wrapped them up, and he just kept wrestling. And it wasn't just that he felt it was his duty to keep wrestling and defend the title until he lost it. It actually had more to do with the fact that when you're on the independent circuit, and that does include Ring of Honor, at that particular time, I think ROH wrestlers might have health coverage now of some kind. I don't know how good it is. But certainly at that time, Nigel would have to have those injuries taken care of on his own. You know, I don't think he had any insurance. I could be wrong about that. And that was also why he decided to forego surgery. He knew he would need surgery. It would keep him out for a long time. Unfortunately, when you have an issue or an injury like that that's pretty serious and you don't have it taken care of, it doesn't just go away. You know, even if it heals up a little bit, you still got two badly damaged arms. And I think his biceps may still be an issue, but from what I understand, this has more to do with past concussions. So anyway, that's the update on Desmond Wolfe and London Brawling and TNA for all the people who have written in to ask about that. Raw from Monday night, I liked that show a lot. I know not everybody did, but for some reason I really liked that show, and it in some instances reminded me of the Attitude Era. It was not as though we were, you know, back in the glory days, and that's, again, not to say the Attitude Era, that every show was so great, but you know, the short match between Sheamus and John Morrison when they were brawling into the crowd and by the stage, and Morrison did the dive off the Titantron, it just feels like we used to see that sort of thing a lot back then, and we don't really see stuff like that too often these days. You know, the tables match with Orton and Cena, I mean, it was what it was. Some of those table bumps by the Nexus members, like Heath Slater and Justin Gabriel, those were some pretty sick table bumps, I must admit. Wade Barrett took a pretty safe one. I don't know, there was something about that show that in certain segments reminded me of days gone by, you know, on Monday Night Raw. And by and large, it was a fun show that passed pretty quickly. You know, some weeks Raw, I mean, we'll be 40 minutes into the show, and it's kind of like Impact, where it's like, oh my God, I can't believe we have another hour and 20 minutes left. Or even this podcast on some weeks. But anyway, I like Raw from Monday night. Now, NXT on Tuesday. I watched NXT in full from start to finish. I did not do that for the first episode. I made it my duty to do so this week. And, wow, are some of these girls bad. Obviously, Caitlyn is a favorite of mine. She's very attractive, and, you know, she didn't offend me in the ring or anything like that. And it looks like they're doing with her and Vicky Guerrero kind of what they did with Miz and Daniel Bryan. in terms of trying to make Caitlyn the sympathetic babyface here. I like Caitlyn a lot. AJ has some talent, but she's so scrawny, and I just don't trust that WWE would really do anything with her, you know? I don't know that she's a good fit for WWE, but she's got talent in the ring. There's no doubt about that. Oksana, she's an attractive girl. That accent just bugs the shit out of me. I can't say that about too many accents. For whatever reason, when she speaks, oh, God, it gets on my nerves. But she's very attractive. She is very attractive, and really, that's all they care about. If you look like you could be in Playboy, which is funny because they don't work with Playboy anymore with the PG shift, but Johnny Ace has told aspiring people who have tried to get into WWE, if you're female, you need to look like somebody who could potentially be in Playboy, or we're not going to give you a second look. That's the criteria by which they're inviting divas into the company. Again, I'll have more to say on this philosophy next week, but the thing about NXT that obviously makes it a must-see show is Michael Cole. And again, I never thought I'd hear myself say those words, but it's true. Michael Cole is a completely different person on this show. He absolutely could not care less about being there. He is offended by the fact, in fact, that he has to be there calling the show. His character is so offended, you know, hammering the gong this week. And, of course, at the end of the show, Cole simply got up and quit and walked out. And the thing is, that wasn't even the best part of the show. The best part of the show was earlier on, they were having a joke-off where all of the aspiring divas were in the ring and they had to tell a joke. They put them on the spot. Again, these girls mostly are not told in advance. You know, the people backstage, they do it just for shits and giggles. They want to see how these girls react. And Naomi, who is one of the standout performers on this show, she's very athletic. You know, Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer has made the comment that backstage people refer to her as the female Shelton Benjamin, which is a term of endearment. It's not meant to be an insult, but it's meant to be a compliment in the respect that when Shelton was there, even though they felt he didn't try hard enough, he was naturally the best athlete on that entire roster, and people respected him for that. And that's kind of the way they look at Naomi. She's a very talented girl. But Naomi told a joke. I think her joke was, it was something about a dog who's missing a leg or something. I don't remember the exact joke, but basically, after she told it, you know, Michael Cole was laughing and he made the comment. He said, "I want Naomi to win every competition so this show ends earlier." I lost it at that point. And even Matt Stryker, who was in the ring and has an earpiece in his ear so he can hear what the announcers are saying, he started chuckling and he had to turn around and he even said, "Well, even Michael Cole has great jokes." That was awesome. That was the best line I have heard in forever. And like I said, later on, Cole ended up quitting. He walked off the show. He was saying, "I was used to be a war correspondent, and now you've got me covering this show," which is true, by the way. Because in the early 90s, Michael Cole was actually, I think, an embedded journalist over in Iraq during the first Gulf War for CBS News. So if I'm Michael Cole in real life, I probably feel that way. But anyway, Cole walked off NXT, and we are led to believe that he is not going to come back. If that is true, there is no reason to watch NXT anymore. Michael Cole was just a total 180 on this show. I mean, it looks like more of this heel persona is coming through on Raw each week, but still, you've got a guy who is sitting there, and you're watching a show that you know is shit, and the announcer on the show says, basically, "Yeah, this show is shit, I don't know why I'm here." First of all, that is awesome. But second of all, if I'm WWE, probably not so awesome to be telling people that this show sucks when it actually does suck. But in any event, if Michael Cole is gone, who do they replace him with? Well, they've talked about potentially Byron Saxton, who is still down in FCW, and they had him up doing some announcing for ECW before that brand got folded up. They're talking maybe about bringing him back. They've got Abraham Washington, maybe having Todd Grisham, who is the lead announcer for SmackDown, do NXT with Josh Matthews. Matthews is really good. Hopefully he'll stay, but any of those options is not nearly as appealing as heel Michael Cole. So if he is gone, I don't know that I will be paying much attention to NXT these next couple of weeks. Cole is just so damn enjoyable on that show. It's just, there's something about, as a straight play-by-play wrestling announcer, I just don't think he's that good. I mean, when he was with Taz all those years on SmackDown, he was pretty good. And the fact that he went to Raw and was as awful as he was is indicative of either one of two things. Either Taz was so good for him to play off of that it was really Taz doing most of the good work and carrying Michael Cole. And I'm not so sure I'd buy into that. Or Cole really isn't as bad as we all think he is, but Vince McMahon has scared him so much, or has put the handcuffs on him so tight in terms of what he can and cannot say on Monday nights, that it just makes him a horrible announcer. I'm sure that that is true to some degree. But all I know is I have thoroughly enjoyed the heel tendencies of Michael Cole. And like I've said before, they've got bigger plans for him. You know, this whole heel thing on Raw, this is going somewhere. I still firmly believe he'll be the general manager. And even if he isn't, hopefully they do something with this, because he is far more entertaining as a heel persona than just a straight play-by-play guy. All right, so let me just give some quick Night of Champions thoughts. Again, I'm sure most of you, by the time you're listening to this, the pay-per-view will either be in progress or over, so I don't want to spend too much time on this. But basically, Night of Champions tonight, there is nothing on this show that makes me think this pay-per-view is going to do very well. Their pay-per-view business is just in a downward spiral, and I've got a plan for that. I'll talk about that next week. But as for tonight, Big Show and CM Punk, one of the few matches on this show that is not for a championship. I've got to go with CM Punk just because Big Show's been given everything in this feud. You know, that handicap match last month with Mercury and with Gallows, Big Show won that. Punk really needs something strong right now. He needs a win, and I don't know if he'll get it, but I'm going with CM Punk in this match. Dolph Ziggler, Kofi Kingston. I'm just going to go with Ziggler in this match. In fact, most of my picks I've noticed here are all heel. So I would be shocked if all of these predictions came to fruition, because I'm going to go with Ziggler in the IC title match. I will go with Melina in the unification match for the Divas and Women's Championship. I'm going to pick The Miz over Daniel Bryan. It just seems like Bryan has been booked to look a lot stronger than The Miz has recently. And I don't necessarily see a reason to end this feud at Night of Champions. I think you can have Miz go over with some help from Alex Riley and carry this over for another one or two pay-per-views. So I'm just going to go out on a wing and pick The Miz in that one. Kane and The Undertaker. Now, we all know that if you add up all the matches Kane and Undertaker have ever had, which probably totals about 3,500, I'm guessing, at least, Undertaker probably went over in about 99.9% of those matches. I don't even know what to say here. I mean, the only match that I can ever remember Kane winning over The Undertaker one-on-one, if I remember correctly, is a match on Raw back in 1998 that Kane won, I believe, to get a title shot at the King of the Ring with Stone Cold Steve Austin. That may be the only one. So Kane is having his one last run, most likely, with the World Championship. He deserves it. He's worked hard for it. I don't necessarily want to see Kane drop the title that fast. I know that they're going with the idea of a Kane-Undertaker Hell in a Cell match at the next pay-per-view. Excuse me. At the next pay-per-view, rather. And I just think Kane should hold on to that championship at least until Hell in a Cell. So my pick in this match is Kane. Six-pack challenge. You have Sheamus defending against Edge, Randy Orton, John Cena, Wade Barrett, and Chris Jericho. It is now an elimination match, which in my opinion, makes the match a lot more, you know, enjoyable than having six guys in the ring, first pinfall wins. You know, to me, there's something lame about that. I like the elimination aspect of it. It'll probably make for a longer match than we would have had originally. If I had to pick two guys in this match, I mean, my pick is Sheamus, but if I had to pick two guys, would not shock me the way that Randy Orton has been pushed to see Orton go over and win the championship here. Again, the plan was, and I believe still is, to go for a Sheamus-Randy Orton cell match at the October pay-per-view, which means one or the other would have to have the title, and I think if that's what you're going for, just make Sheamus look stronger by having him come out of the six-pack challenge with the title. I mean, if Sheamus can somehow hold on to that championship belt, he'll look that much stronger. And the way that we've seen titles change hands over the last year plus, you know, keeping the title on somebody longer than just a couple of weeks, probably a good idea, just to make the title mean something special. So, anyway, that's the quick Night of Champions rundown right there. Almost a clean sweep for the heels. Interesting. I'll tell you what else is interesting. Your feedback. Bust open the mailbag here. By the way, you can check out the latest edition of the SE Scoops mailbag on the main page. I answered a whole shit ton of questions this week. Some really good ones, too. So if you have not already done so, definitely check that out. But let's get to the sound-off mailbag, the only one that really matters. John from Northern Ireland, our good buddy, writes into the podcast, Dear Solomonster, I missed most of Raw last week, but I love the Miz and Daniel Bryan segment. The Miz story really is a feel-good story in a way, even if he is, in storyline, the biggest prick in the company. After Miz hightailed it out of the ring and went to pick up the briefcase opened up, revealing its contents to be empty. And obviously there is no contract in there, as it was supposed to be in storyline. So, effectively, it's just a shiny red suitcase right now. My question is, was that the first time ever that we've seen the interior of the Money in the Bank briefcase? I believe it was, and that was from Raw, I believe, the week before, not this past week, but that was pretty embarrassing. when the briefcase came open, I noticed it right away, and I said, oh, I had a facepalm, because I knew that's embarrassing. Yeah, in theory, there's supposed to be at least a piece of paper in there, which is supposed to be a contract giving you a championship match, and look, it's just a formality, it's not a big deal, but you would think they can put one of those stupid amateur-looking WWE contracts together with the, you know, the giant Raw logo on it or something. You just stick it in there just so something is in there in the event that it accidentally gets opened up, but apparently not. So maybe they've learned their lesson for the future, but that was a pretty embarrassing faux pas. Got a letter here from one of our longtime listeners since episode one, in fact. Niels, I hope that's his the correct pronunciation of his name, from the Netherlands, writing into the sound off this week. Dear Solomonster, I don't know if it's just me, but has wrestling programming been less and less entertaining over the course of the last few years. Most of the companies, including WWE, TNA, ROH, have a plethora of strong, fit talent, but it seems like they never know what to do with them. I'm sick and tired of constantly seeing rehashed feuds like Kane and Undertaker, or still ongoing feuds like Kofi and Dolph. It all comes down to this. If you had a choice to select some of the WWE lower card wrestlers like a Vance Archer, Hawkins, Yoshitatsu, any of those guys, who would you pick and what would you do with them? I'd love to see some unknown wrestlers become a bit more known, because we all know most of the lower card guys have a great deal of talent. Archer, to me, and Hawkins are useless. I have no use for those guys. Yoshitatsu is very talented. And even so, even in his role as basically a lower card job guy, he's still pretty popular amongst fans. And they're always looking for international stars as they expand their horizons, so to speak. So why they don't do more with Yoshitatsu, I really don't know. But Tatsu is one of those guys, just using one of the examples you gave, that I would definitely want to do more with. I mean, I don't know what storyline I would concoct for him to be in. He's more of a guy who, you just put him in there and he'll probably have a great match. Again, I'm going to be doing virtually an entire podcast next week where I talk specifically, one of the points I talk about is talent. And not even so much underutilized talent currently on the WWE roster, but more so, who would I bring into the company from the outside? Who would I bring in from TNA? Who would I bring in from ROH? Who would I bring in from the independent circuit? I've got an entire list. I'm going to go through all of this next week. And just to answer your question, I mean, the fact is, I'm not saying that wrestling should be devoid of storylines or even comedy. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's an over-reliance on that. Like you said, if you look at the rosters of all the companies up and down, by and large, there is a great deal of talent and a lot of guys who know how to work. And the problem is that they're not allowed to do what they do best. Their strengths are often hidden or underutilized. Their weaknesses are often exposed. And they just are not given the option to go out there and have a great match. So if you can give them that freedom more so to do that, and just come up with a couple of compelling stories to kind of wrap those matches up in, instead of, like you said, rehashing the same shit over and over again, I think wrestling would be far more enjoyable than it is right now. Far more enjoyable. Bill Mitchell. My buddy Bill writes in, longtime listener since the 50s. And he turns 33 next month, so he apologizes for his shitty memory. Question is this. With the different verbiage train wrecks on social networking sites like Twitter taking place, is it time for Vince McMahon and Dixie Carter to rein their talent in and come up with some sort of posting policy? Of course, you made mention of Kevin Nash and Matt Hardy having meltdowns. There's Matt Hardy again. But if any fans are followers of talent on these social networking sites, they've seen just about everything. For example, the Beautiful People and Lay Cool having an exchange over supposed gimmick infringement. Awesome Kong and Todd Klem, better known as Bubba the Love Fuck, I mean Sponge, exchanging unpleasantries. I've even seen certain talent use their social networking sites to exchange photos and videos of various debauchery antics and activities. So, Zolomonster, should something be done about this? If it were you, would you impose an online usage policy? Well, again, I'm going to talk a lot about policies and such next week, although I don't think Twitter was in my rundown, but my thoughts on Twitter are this. There's something called freedom of speech. And you gotta respect freedom of speech. I get that. However, on the flip side, if you work for an employer, you are expected to conduct yourself inside the ring and even more so outside the ring in a certain way, so as not to portray your company in a negative light. I see the flip side of that as well. There's nothing that I would be able to do if I were in charge of WWE or TNA where I could turn around and say, you, Kevin Nash, you are no longer allowed to post on Twitter. I am not in a position to say that. I can say it, but I'm not in a position to do anything about that. And quite frankly, I think that would be wrong to tell people you're not allowed to do this or you're not allowed to do that, especially if it's a social networking vehicle outside of office time. You can't tell people you can't post on Twitter. I mean, if you work in an office, you can block websites from your network and say you can't go on Twitter and Facebook during working hours. But if Kevin Nash gets drunk off a bottle of wine at his home at midnight and decides to start posting shit, you can't tell him not to do that. I would handle things on a case-by-case basis. So, for example, if I were in control of WWE, not to get ahead of myself here for next week, but if I were, and Matt Hardy was pulling the same shit that he's pulling right now, I would not hesitate at all to fire his ass on the spot. Because, to me, Matt Hardy, talented as he may be, smart as he may like to think he is at this point to WWE virtually worthless. There is no way I would ever put him in a position of any sort of power on the roster. So, for example, I'm not going to give him a push as any sort of singles champion. I'm not going to have the faith and confidence in him to make him a main eventer where he can actually make me some money. So of what use is he to me then? I would get rid of him. Kevin Nash pulls that same stunt on me. Me and him are going to sit down and have a chat. And that goes for anybody. I think you have to address these things on a case-by-case basis. If that sort of behavior continues, then you have to start making an example out of people. That's how it works. You've got to scare the life out of them. So if I'm TNA and people are just going wild on Twitter and this person saying this and this person saying that, you can bet your ass at least one of those people is going to get the axe. And that really, more so than anything else, would serve as a message to others: watch yourself. And that's really the only way you can handle a situation like that. You can't come up with a blanket rule that says you are not allowed to post on Twitter. You can't do what WWE has done. And WWE enforces unofficially their own policy that tells talent no posting on Twitter after midnight. Now, there are people who still do that. Chris Jericho, for example, who I don't think has ever really been a problem to them in this respect. I'm sure they're not happy about the fact that he doesn't keep kayfabe on his Twitter, but it's his own personal Twitter. He can do whatever he wants. Jericho still posts after midnight, and certain people do. But that was a policy WWE decided to come up with. No late-night posting on Twitter, because, of course, if you're posting after midnight, more often than not, that probably means that you're out partying, or you've perhaps been drinking, or you know, if you're not in bed by midnight, you must be doing something bad. So that was the logic behind them doing that. But again, they can't enforce that. They cannot force people to not post a message on Twitter at 12:15 a.m. if they want to do that. You can't do that. You have to take it on a case-by-case basis, and that's what I would do. Andrew writes in, he was watching WrestleMania 21, which was 5 years ago. 5.5 years ago now. And in that time, John Cena has been champion 10 times, which is crazy. Hogan had the belt 5 times until he left for WCW in 1994, but he held the belt for years, and yet his act never got old. Well, I would dispute that, but anyway. Granted, he can't wrestle at all, but still, he's not overexposed like John Cena is right now. Then you take Randy Orton. He's had the belt 6 times. That's way too many, and Edge has had it 9 times in a very short period of time. It just gets ridiculous. Well, look, I'm not going to argue with you over that. I mean, Edge, talented as he is, Edge didn't win his first WWE Championship until January of 2006. Okay, that was the New Year's Revolution pay-per-view when Cena won the Elimination Chamber, Edge came out, cashed in Money in the Bank, and beat him. That was his first title, and since the beginning of 2006, Edge has been a 9-time world champion. That is ridiculous. I agree. John Cena. Now, again, to say that Hogan was never overexposed, I'm going to have to debate you on that point. Now, when I grew up, I was a Hulkamaniac. Okay, I wasn't a baby, but I was young enough to not know any of this stuff. I watched TV. Hogan, I will give you this much, was not overexposed in one respect. Hogan was not on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge every week. In fact, it was very, very rare for Hogan to appear on those shows in action. He was saved for special occasions. He was saved, his big matches were for the big pay-per-view events, for Saturday night's main event, things of that nature. However, believe me, after a couple of years, there were plenty of fans in the late 80s and the early 90s, like many of the fans now, talking about John Cena, who were saying, "I am so sick of Hulk Hogan's act." And Hogan started getting booed. I mean, my favorite example of this is again, I keep going back to it every example I give, but the 1992 Royal Rumble. I mean, if you watch the end of that match when Sid dumped Hogan out of the ring, the crowd went nuts. I mean, people were so sick of Hogan at that point. And the thing is, Hogan really wasn't doing much at that point for WWE business. And when it became obvious that people were so tired of his act, if I were Vince McMahon, I would have done what Eric Bischoff did years later. Only I would have done it a couple of years earlier. I would have made 1992 had Hogan not disappeared, the year that Hulk Hogan turned heel. And I think it would have been a huge, huge deal. Now, would it have gotten over the way that Hogan's heel turn did in WCW in 96 when wrestling in general was a lot edgier than it was in the early 90s? Perhaps. I mean, we'll never know. But I couldn't understand why Vince never turned Hogan heel towards the end of his run in 92-93 when it was obvious that Hogan really was not much of a draw anymore. I mean, at that point, you know, you weren't going to turn Hogan heel 3 or 4 years earlier because you would have been insane, just like it would have been insane for WWE to turn John Cena at the beginning when he was really, you know, the company's top babyface. And then they got to a point where they probably could have turned Cena heel and they chose not to. But the fact is, I always thought Vince should have capitalized on that before Bischoff ever did. And they could have made some big bucks, I think, with Hogan as a bad guy in the WWF. Who he would have feuded with, that's the question. You know, Savage? You know, a babyface Savage against a heel Hogan, would that have worked? I mean, they were trying to push younger guys at that point. You know, could you have done Bret Hart, perhaps? Davey Boy Smith? The Warrior? You know? You can come up with a million different possibilities, but Hogan was most definitely overexposed in his early run, too. And in many cases, it's just like the John Cena thing. But I agree. Title belts are treated like shit, and I'll talk more about that next week in terms of what I would do to remedy that situation. Sluggish writes into the podcast. Hopefully he's not feeling very sluggish today. Dear Solid Monster, hope everything is going well. Just saying thanks for a long sound off last week. The longer the better. Well, I don't know about that. My question is, Chris Jericho has the gimmick where he believes he is the best in the world at what he does. Do you think there is any legitimacy to that statement? Personally, I agree with Jericho. He's not the best, and he's in the top three for sure. At least I think so. I also, do you agree with what you said Sunday about Jericho losing to all these younger guys in order to help them, dragging him down somewhat? But through and through, we have seen Jericho as one of the best wrestlers, regardless, in the ring and on the mic. What are your thoughts? Hard to argue. I mean, find me somebody who overall is better than Jericho right now in wrestling. In terms of promos, in terms of ring work, in terms of just the way he presents himself. In terms of a media guy, you know, if I would have no problem if Chris Jericho won the world title tonight at the Night of Champions. I don't expect him to, but if he did, he's a fine representative for the company. He wears some of the best suits that I've seen any of the wrestlers wear. He's all over the media. I mean, obviously he's got his band. You know, he appears on VH1 quite often, but as a go-to guy for media opportunities for TV shows and radio interviews, Jericho is a fine representative for the company. He really, in many ways, is the total package for them. So hard to argue. I mean, it's obviously a subjective thing. And Jericho, I feel, in the ring, you know, you get older. Jericho's in his late 30s now. He's not, you know, exactly what he was 10 years ago. But still, in the ring, he's matured. He's better in some ways than he used to be. And I do. I believe that Chris Jericho perhaps is, in fact, the best in the world at what he does. All right. Dear Solomonster, been a fan of the podcast for about a year now. It's a pleasure to listen every week. I was wondering if you think the pop at Madison Square Garden for Triple H's return from his quad tear in 2002 was as big as Jim Ross and the rest of WWE really made it out to be, or was it just WWE trying to bring Triple H back with a bang? It was a big pop. You know, it was a live Raw. It certainly didn't sound as though they were sweetening the crowd noise. Now, I could have been at that show that night. I should have been at that show that night. I was not. So I cannot vouch for the pop being that big in terms of me being there. But I'm almost positive if you've talked to anybody who was there that night, they would tell you that it was a huge reception that he got coming out. And it just had more to do with, you know, they hyped his return for weeks with those YouTube videos. Triple H, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Sick as people, myself included, might have been of him in 01, he disappeared for 8 months. And at that point, you know, his return had some novelty to it. Now, in my opinion, it wore off pretty quick. Triple H was not nearly as good as he was when he got hurt. He put on a lot of muscle. He put on a lot of weight. I'll leave it up to you guys to figure out why that was. But he wasn't the performer that he used to be. He came back. His matches weren't as good. He was boring as a babyface, so thankfully they turned him heel later in the year. But the pop that he got at MSG that night was huge. Now, I know Jim Ross on commentary made the comment that, well, you know, this is as big as any sustained roar I've ever heard at Madison Square Garden. He may have been telling the truth. It was a long, long pop. I mean, Triple H came out. He went to the ring. He posed on all the turnbuckles to the point that his music, you know, which was probably about 3 or 4 minutes long, started over again. You know, that's how long and sustained the reaction was. So I don't think it was Jim Ross selling it so much as it really just was a big pop, and JR just happened to do a really good job of putting it over. Big shock. Jim Ross is good at what he does. Chaz from Highland, California writes in, "Dear Solomonster, do you think Vince McMahon will ever try to buy TNA and have them invade WWE like the invasion from 2001 when Vince bought WCW? Or do you think Dixie Carter would not go for that?" I don't think it's going to happen either way, so it's kind of a moot point. All right, a couple more here. We've got a question from Skullhead, if that is your real name, dear Solomonster. "Seems that there has been an increase in wrestling deaths over the last 4 to 5 years. Perhaps it's because I'm getting older and paying more attention to it, but it made me wonder if there was any one single year that had the most deaths." Yeah, 2010. Hello. I think we've covered probably about 10 wrestler deaths in the last 6 to 8 weeks alone. But besides 2010, I went back and looked. I didn't look at every year, but one year that jumped out at me when I first read this question, and I had to go back and check, and I don't know if this was, in fact, the biggest year for wrestler deaths. I'm sure, actually, that it wasn't, but 2003 stood out to me for some reason, so I looked it up, and just in terms of the popular people and former WWF, so this doesn't necessarily include every wrestler that died that year, but in 2003, we lost Mr. Perfect, Miss Elizabeth, Fred Blassie, Road Warrior Hawk, and Crash Holly. And that's a lot of guys to lose in one year. But again, 2010, and really just in the last couple of months alone, you know, obviously Lance Cade and Luna Vachon jump out at you, and then there's been a litany of older people. I mean, it's kind of hard. I mean, if you have a wrestler, an older wrestler, who lived to the age of 80 and he died, do you kind of lump that in with wrestler deaths? I mean, he was a wrestler. He did die. But again, wrestler deaths, I think, have come to be associated with drugs and other you know, negative stigmas that are typically attached to it. So it's kind of unfair, I think, to lump some of those people you know, like, I forgot his name already, but the old ring announcer for Wrestling at the Chase from St. Louis, who I think was 80-something years old when he died a couple of weeks ago. You know, we lost Jack Briscoe this year as well. Skandor Akbar, Ted Allen. Just, we've lost too many current and former pro wrestlers, I think, in these last couple of months. So 2010 has actually been a horrific year, and it's not over yet, unfortunately, in terms of wrestling deaths. And that's not to say that there's going to be more necessarily. I'm just saying the year is not over, and I think if you are in the wrestling business, you probably cannot wait for 2010 to be over. Kevin writes in, "Dear Solomonster, been listening since episode 30. Was wondering if you were going to be attending the TNA House Show on September 23rd in New York City. I will be going, but I'm going to the one in Oklahoma City being run on the same day. I'm kind of puzzled, actually, because it looks like the Oklahoma City show, with the roster that will be there, will be getting a better show than New York City, which is good for me, but weird in a business sense, since they will run our show at the fair and run your show at the Hammerstein Ballroom. What do you think?" First of all, I will not be at the TNA show. I've been to the Hammerstein for Ring of Honor shows before. It's a really nice, intimate venue. It's small, but you could still fit, you know, in the Hammerstein, you could probably fit between 2,500 and 3,000 people in there. I will not be at the show. As for, does it sound ass backwards that TNA might put a better show on at the fair in Oklahoma than in New York? All I have to say to that is, it's TNA. What do you expect? Now, in their defense, TNA house shows are probably some of the best shows they have. So, even if the show is better in Oklahoma City than it is in New York City, I think both shows will probably end up being pretty good. And if you have the opportunity to buy a ticket and go to a TNA live event, I would actually urge you to do so. I've been to two different TNA live events, including one this past summer at the baseball stadium, MCU Park in Brooklyn, and I had a blast. I mean, the shows are really good, And it's more of an intimate fan experience than you'll ever get at a WWE house show. I will say that. So for all the crap I talk about TNA, and again, I talk crap because they deserve it. You know, all you TNA fanboys out there who like to write hate mail into me, just know that the reason I talk shit about TNA is because I want them to get better and because they fucking deserve it. But I will not talk shit about their house shows because they are, in fact, very good. And like I said, if you can go to one, I would definitely recommend that you do so. Chris writes into the Sound Off. Dear Solomonster, I have a question for you. Michael Cole, who I've also invested some of my fan interest in of late, stated that on the recent edition of NXT, he stated he was in a match for the Tag Team Championship once. It was a quick comment that was in passing, but it was funny. I thought I would remember something like that. Can you help me out? When was this? I kind of want to see it. I bet it would be funny. Not doubting it, I just thought I would not have forgotten something as far-fetched as that, so I must have missed it. Now, when I got the question from Chris, I thought I would know about that too, and I racked my brain. I cannot remember Michael Cole getting a Tag Team Championship shot. I don't remember who that would have been with. I mean, I'm sure it was just a one-off stupid thing on an edition of Raw or SmackDown, but I cannot remember it. I actually am stumped. I just don't know. So if anybody out there listening knows anything about this and perhaps can write in and shed some light on when this would have taken place with a backstory behind it, both Chris and myself would very much appreciate that. Quiet question from John here. Dear Solomonster, what do you think of William Regal as GM as he was a couple of years back? I thought he was great, especially when he would call Triple H, Triple H. Well, William Regal was fucking awesome as the Raw GM, and then, of course, William Regal was no longer fucking awesome. He just fucked up. He failed a wellness exam. He was suspended, and his push at that point was derailed. I think they had bigger things in store for him. Not that he necessarily would have been world champion or anything like that, but although I certainly think he could have carried his load as champion. I thought for the time that he was the GM, when he would be out there and the crowd was booing him and he was getting massive heat and they wouldn't let him speak, so he would turn off the lights. He would kill the show until the fans showed him the respect that he deserved. It started getting a little old at the end, but I thought that his gimmick overall was fantastic. I would love to see him get another shot, but again, Regal is one of these guys. He's got two strikes against him in the company, which means if he, you know, fucks up one more time, he is going to be terminated. And it seems like he's on the straight and narrow right now and everything's cool. And you would think and you would hope that he's learned from whatever mistakes he's made in the past. But again, if I'm WWE, I've already put my faith in this guy two different times before. And they gave him a big push as GM. You know, he won the King of the Ring tournament, I think it was back in 07 or 08. It was 08 when they had the King of the Ring on Raw. He won the King of the Ring. He was coming out on the throne every week. He was the GM. And again, he messed up. Not WWE. And I would be leery, too, of giving him another big opportunity like that. But for the time that he was the GM, I thought he was great. Jason writes into the podcast, a fine name. Just thought of a question for you. I listened to an old podcast and realized you were not happy with how Bill Goldberg lost his first match in WCW to Kevin Nash by way of Scott Hall's interference with a taser. That would have been at Starrcade 98. Looking back, I can't say that I blame you. My question is, if you were in charge at the time, how would you have dealt with Goldberg? Would you have let him leave undefeated? Have someone else beat him? And if so, how? This is a really good question. And, you know, obviously what I would have done was let the streak go on a little bit longer. Because the fact is, Goldberg had first won the championship on Nitro from Hogan in July of 98. So when Starrcade came along in December, it was only a couple of months later, and Goldberg was still the hottest commodity in that company, and he was still undefeated. Now, I can tell you this much. Whoever I would have had beat Goldberg, and to answer your first question, I would not have let Goldberg go undefeated his entire career in WCW. That would be foolish. But I would not have had Kevin Nash beat him. I would have kept Kevin Nash as far away from Goldberg as possible. I stand corrected. I would have had Goldberg beat Nash, and then I would have kept Nash away from Goldberg as much as possible. Now, from what I understand, when Hogan beat Goldberg, there was some sort of agreement. I don't know if it was written in a contract or anything, but it is Hulk Hogan here, so you can't possibly be surprised by this. Hogan lost clean to Goldberg at the Georgia Dome with the agreement that Hogan would be the first person to beat Goldberg. When the time would come for Goldberg to lose the belt, Hogan wanted to be that person. So if it wasn't Kevin Nash, it probably would have been Hulk Hogan. And in my opinion, that would not have been that much of a better choice. I would have had Goldberg continue to go undefeated into 1999. Inevitably, Goldberg would have started to feel some backlash. Everybody does at some point, from the fans. The key is, when you first sense that this is happening, that's when you strike. So in other words, you don't kill the guy when he's still hot, and you don't kill the guy when everybody's already turned against him because he's already dead. You've got to pay attention. You've got to pay attention to fan response online. You've got to pay attention, most importantly, to fan reactions at the arenas. And when you start to sense that people are turning on Goldberg, that people are starting to get sick of Goldberg, that's when you concoct your plan. That's when you come up, whoever you want, to be that one guy that's going to beat Goldberg, take the title and get the rub from him. That's when you go for it. You can't be too early. You can't be too late. When Goldberg lost to Nash, the fact that he lost to Nash was ridiculous. Nash, by the way, at that time was the booker for WCW. Big surprise, I know. But again, the time was all wrong. Now, maybe the right time would have been 3 months later. Maybe the right time would have been 6 months later. Maybe Goldberg could have been hot, popping big ratings for another year. Maybe. It's quite possible. And Lord knows, when they turned Goldberg heel, that was a disaster. In my opinion, even more of a disaster than the Austin heel turn from 2001, which Steve Austin today says was one of the biggest mistakes he ever made in his career. Who would I have beat Goldberg? You know, I could say that I would have taken a younger guy, but I can't think, you know, could it have been a Chris Jericho or, you know, a Chris Benoit, perhaps? You know, if WCW would have pushed them correctly, but that's a lot of ifs in that scenario. I can't say for sure who that one person would have been, in part because I don't know when I would have done it. You know, would I have done it 3 months after Starrcade? I don't know. If Goldberg was still hot, no, I wouldn't have done it. If 9 months later, people, more and more people were starting to boo Goldberg at the buildings, maybe ratings started to slip a little bit, at that point, I would have evaluated the talent roster in WCW, and I would have said, all right, I've got a group of three guys or five guys here to choose from. These are the younger guys. These are the guys that are getting over. These are the guys that I want to push. I want to take this one guy who may not be that over and know that by giving him a victory over Bill Goldberg, that one victory might launch them into the stratosphere. I can't honestly sit here and tell you who that person would have been because I don't know who would have been at that time pushed by WCW enough to have been the right person. I don't know. But I know that I wouldn't have done it the way they did it, that's for sure. All right, last question here. Russell writes in, Dear Solomonster, which current WWE superstars, excluding the NXT rookies and recent acquisitions, have never held a WWE title? All I can think of are Chris Masters, Vladimir Kozlov, and Luke Gallows. Do you think another reason that belts are so worthless is the fact that practically every superstar has held one at some point? Well, obviously, if you look up and down the roster, more people have held belts now than at any point in history. And in fact, they've done so multiple times. Belts mean nothing. This is not a newsflash here. But you are being a little too dramatic. I mean, yes, Masters, Kozlov, and Gallows have not held belts, but, you know, neither has Yoshitatsu, you know, nor has Primo Colon. I believe he and Carlito were going to win the tag belts, but I don't think that ever happened. I think Carlito got released. So, yes, Primo never held a belt. Yoshi never held a belt. You know, somebody like Vance Archer, who is not a recent acquisition, he's been on the roster for a while. He's never held a belt in WWE, and I'm sure there's a couple of other examples as well. So, that's not true, but your overall point is correct. Belts don't mean anything because if everybody has one, then, you know, why should it feel special when somebody does win a championship? Look at the six-pack challenge tonight, Night of Champions. You've got Sheamus, who is a two-time WWE champion. You've got Randy Orton, who has held the world title six times and every other major title there is to hold. John Cena, I don't need to say anything. Wade Barrett has not. But Wade Barrett, I guess, would fall under the classification of a recent acquisition. So we'll set him aside for now. Edge, 9-time champion. Chris Jericho, multiple-time champion. In fact, he has more intercontinental titles than any superstar in history. It's the same old, same old. Everybody's held a belt at least five different times, and so why should they mean anything? I agree. Absolutely. So, we're going to cinch up the mailbag here. another week down. Some great questions from you guys, as always. I want more. I want more questions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. And also, what I want from you guys is more sound bites. I want to thank the few people who sent in some new ones this past week, Geronimo, and there was one other person. I still am going to be putting together certain things or inserting little sound bites into the show in the future, so it's not too late to record in MP3 or WAV format your own little sound-off sound bite, much like the ones that you hear at the end of the podcast every week. So get those into me via email at thesolomonster@gmail.com if you can. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solomonster. Let's get me over 600 followers. And facebook.com, friend me on there at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. So next week, like I've been saying throughout this week's show, I'm going to have a special edition of The Sound Off, episode 127. Now, if there is breaking news during the week, and you know there will be, I will certainly cover that. But by and large, what I would like to make next week's show about is my business review of WWE. I've had people, like I said before, who've written into me asking me questions every week. What would you do if you were in charge? What would you do if you had the power to do this and the power to do that? I'm not going to talk about booking storylines. That's not what it's about next week. I'm going to be evaluating every aspect of WWE, from the talent to pay-per-views to television to the website to the wellness policy, to their policies on blood and you know, the PG rating, and their policies on banning interviews from news sites and everything in between, and the things that I would tweak, the things that I would change completely, the things that I would add, the things that I agree with and I think should not be changed, all of those things. We'll go into that next week, and I promise I'll make it as fun as possible. It won't be as boring as it might sound. And in fact, this is a good week to warn. If anybody from WWE was going to listen to one episode of The Sound Off, let it be next week's show. Let them listen to The Sound Off next week. And if they took even three ideas from the ideas that I'm going to outline next week, I can tell you that their company would be better off for it. So that will be next week. And until then, be well, stay safe. Take it easy, guys. We'll see you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SCScoops.com.